Welcome to the second in a two-part interview with award-winning British film director Phil Grabsky. In our first interview, Phil and I talked about the state of documentary filmmaking and also about the making of his film, My Childhood, My Country, 20 Years in Afghanistan. In the second part, we'll talk about Phil's celebrated exhibition on screen series and how he has brought to the cinema the true stories behind many great artists and great exhibitions. If you're on Vashon Island on October 29th, you'll be able to see one of the latest in the series, My National Gallery, London. Welcome to Embracing the Muse. I'm your host, Sally Jean Fox, the author of Meeting the Muse After Midlife. And I'm on a quest to discover and understand how we can live our richest, most meaningful and creative lives at any age. It's been so interesting to see these multifaceted sides of your work that you take us deep into Afghanistan, and then you also take us deep into the world of art. And in some ways they look different, but in some ways they're similar, because the thing that I really appreciate about your work is that you aren't trying to sensationalize, glamorize, create a story that wasn't really there, the way might have happened in the film Amadeus about Mozart, or the film Frida about Frida Kahlo, because they have to boost the interest in the film, and by making it glamorous or sensational, you can kind of build that. But you actually are taking us to the real stories that live within, that are actually even more interesting, but rarely covered.
So I totally agree. So I think the BBC is guilty of this. You know, when they look at Picasso, it'll be Picasso's women. When they look at Mozart, they have really poor dramatizations, and they exaggerate, grossly exaggerate sometimes his, you know, they'll say he was a philanderer, a gambler, an alcoholic. These things are simply not true. Sometimes the reality is they're just really hardworking and passionate and intelligent. You know, we've just finished a film on Van Gogh, which is really interesting, because it's based on the biggest ever Van Gogh exhibition in Britain at the National Gallery right now. And it's about the 2 years he spends in the south of France. And people still have this idea of Van Gogh as that his painting is an expression of his madness. First of all, madness is an incorrect term. He had mental health issues and he was aware of them. And by and large, when he was having an episode, he wasn't painting. When he's painting, it's not an expression of his mental health. It's an expression of a man who is extraordinarily literate. He spoke and wrote in five different languages. He read literature. He read poetry, Whitman, Plutarch. He's talking to other artists. He's studying, going to galleries. Hugely intelligent. And he chooses to paint in this way, not because it's an expression of his mind and he has no choice. He's deliberately choosing to paint in the way that he paints, and his paintings have multi-layered, fantastic storyteller. I don't need to exaggerate, you know, that he was like a Kirk Douglas or Wilhelm Defoe, that he's kind of mad and crazed and a danger to women on the streets and in and out of the brothels. And I mean, we mention it, that he says in one letter he went to the brothel every 2 weeks, whether he did or not, whether it was more frequent or less frequent. But we quote from one of his letters. But actually, much more important is, where does this creativity come from? When you watch Van Gogh Poets and Lovers, you will be amazed, particularly if you get to see it in the cinema, like in Vashon, you will be amazed at his creative genius. And I think what ultimately unifies the various films that I've made over the years, the 200 plus, is a desire to explore the creative potential of humans. So Mir has absolutely nothing. He's a child with his family, have a blanket and a pot. That's about it. No photographs, but I mean, nothing. No, barely any jewelry, nothing. But out of that, he's extraordinarily creative as a human being. Similarly, Rembrandt, Mozart, Monet, Beethoven, whoever it might be, you know, where they are examples of what we as humans are capable of. And I find that fascinating. And what tends to unite them is this desire to be the best that they can be. It's not fame and fortune. They don't want to be, you know, that's not the aim. In fact, when you watch the biographies of people who for whom fame and fortune is everything, they tend to end in a, you know, tend to crash and burn. What they want to be is the very best composer they can possibly be. And they want to be respected by those they respect. That's the highest aim. So to understand Mozart, you have to understand that he wanted to be the best musician he could be. And he wanted to be respected. So being made to sit and eat with the cooks by the court of Joseph really offended him, you know. Similarly, Beethoven, who knew he was the best composer in Europe, being summoned by the emperor to give piano lessons to some prelate that's coming through Salzburg, really, or Vienna, really offended him because he felt it was disrespectful. But their lives are absolutely fantastic. Now, Amadeus is a brilliant film, but it's not about Mozart at all. It's about Salieri, and it's about if you want to be considered the greatest composer and you're not, then the pains that Salieri goes through have to be kind of heightened by this young whippersnapper turns up who can barely dress himself, but he just turns out this music as though it was the hand of God. That's 180 degrees from the truth, you know.
Right.
Mozart was,
right,
you know, highly trained, highly intelligent.
You did your film on Mozart before you started the exhibition on screen. Is that right? Was that a commissioned work for you, or had you already started going independent with your...
Yeah, so we basically, when I came back from the first trip to Afghanistan, there was a conversation at home about, you know, maybe the next project could be nearer home. And not involve flying to Afghanistan, and which was fair enough. And I've been interested in Mozart anyway, but I thought, same thing, I've got my camera, I'm going to find out. I working from Amadeus, I thought, I don't believe the Tom Hulce portrayal of him, so I'm going to just try and find out for myself. I'll start by reading his letters, because I knew there were 800 letters that survived. But I'm just going to go and ask experts and musicians. So I had, you know, I've got a good team. There's a team of 10 at Seventh Bar, and one woman who still works for us, her job was to get me access to René Fleming or Daniel Barenboim, whoever it might be. And I would go and ask them. I'd have done my research, which they appreciated because they were being asked interesting questions about the composer. And we'd often get into really nice conversations. And then gradually I filmed a lot of music, a lot of performance. Must have filmed about 11 operas. Often, you know, two cameras. I'm operating both cameras at the same time. So it was, you know, it's an interesting challenge. Crisscrossing Europe, I wanted to go to every location in Europe that Mozart had been to. But there was something rather wonderful about it. Basically, I mean, it was a lot of gear I was lugging around, but I was on my own. So I wasn't having to worry about, you know, will the crew want to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, or, oh, you know, we have to go out to dinner tonight. It's like, it's just me with all this gear. And that creative challenge of, okay, you turn up at an opera house or in a concert hall, how am I going to film this violinist or this piano concerto? And I loved it. You know, I had the technical ability to be able to film and to be able to record, which is, you know, something you need to have. And then I had a really good editor, and slowly we pieced it all together. The essential story was biographical, so we had that, the core of what we were trying to do. There was no intention of making it into four films. It was just going to be one film about Mozart. But again, we're essentially self-funding. In fact, I did have a UK broadcaster that was part funding. But even so, you kind of need the film to be commercial. So I would ask these musicians and composers, conductors, was Mozart the greatest conductor of all time? Because if they said yes, I'd have a nice quote. And they all said the same thing, which is, he was, but there's Beethoven. So when I finished Mozart, I almost, again, to my own shock, I remember the shock on the face of my colleague that I just referred to when I said, you know what, I think we're going to do Beethoven now.
Were you already distributing Mozart at that point, or were you waiting for that to go out?
We were. Yeah. No, we'd started just about, and that was very interesting. I mean, 2006, I had a distributor in Australia who had a few screenings of the Afghan film, and I liked him. I said, I've done this film on Mozart, but I'm not going to distribute it on film. And it basically in 2006, so only 20 years ago, the only way to distribute was on film. But it's very expensive and limiting. He said, you know what? I'm going to talk to the cinemas in Australia who were prohibited from showing a film that wasn't distributed on film. The major studios prohibited them. He said, they have DVD projectors for the ads, the advertisements between films. I'm going to say to them, look, I've got this guy, he's made this documentary about Mozart. Nobody's going to come. Just show it a few times, see how it goes. And he persuaded some cinemas. And I went out to Australia to do a bit of publicity. And I remember it's one of the best moments ever. I remember in Sydney going to this lovely old cinema called the Orpheum, turning up, and Brokeback Mountain had just been released. And that was also playing at the cinema. I got out of the taxi. There was a huge queue down the street. And I thought, as for Brokeback Mountain, I went into the cinema and I realized they were queuing for In Search of Mozart. Fantastic. It wasn't Brokeback Mountain. That film ended up playing in some cinemas in Sydney and Melbourne, Wellington, in New Zealand, for 6 months. In Australia, they have, because land is not such an issue as it is here, when they built their cinemas, they had like 8 screens, 9 screens, 10 screens. So they can start in a small screen, they can give it 2 weeks, and then you word of mouth. The downside of what I do now with exhibition on screen is that we're in this genre called event cinema, is you tend to just get 3 screenings, 4 screenings. And even if they do well, cinemas have kind of got out the habit of just extending. So on the one hand, we're in a lot of cinemas. On the downside is that it doesn't, you know, we never end up just, I mean, our Vermeer film, Vermeer, the greatest exhibition, was very successful, but we had so many cinemas saying, oh, we could play this for weeks. And we're saying, like, well, do. And they said, well, we can't because we've already booked in other things.
Oh, wow.
Only 20 years ago in Australia, for example, they just had the flexibility to keep it running. Mm-hmm. So
you also, I've noticed that you have on your Seventh Art website, people can rent and stream, or
they can download, stream, or buy the DVD.
Yeah.
And DVDs used to be really popular. There has been a decline, as you know, our laptops and our televisions don't have them quite so much. But we still, you know, whenever we do special offers and things like that, we still sell a lot of DVDs. Yeah. But downloading and streaming is very popular. All the exhibition on screens, all the In Search Ofs, and plenty of, I mean, there's about 200 projects on there, actually.
It's amazing. Well, and it's good for people on Vashon, because we're going to see a couple of your films. But there's so many, and to have them reasonably priced, so it's less than the price of a movie ticket to watch these great works and all. Well, I heard that in an interview, you were talking about how once exhibition on screen really kicked in, people started approaching you, and they wanted you to film their exhibit. And it feels like it has really built a lot of momentum. Has that helped you with the funding? Are you pre-funded, or, you know? If so, it's an incredible body of work.
So we were making kind of shorter exhibition films for television in the middle 2000s, but I could see the way broadcast was going. So then because the composer films had done well in the cinema, that there was an increasing appetite in the cinema. There was also the development of something called alternative cinema, which is now known as event cinema, with the Met Opera, National Theatre.
Where people watch the performances live, yeah.
Yeah, which were live, hence the term event. So I decided to make one about the huge Leonardo exhibition at the National Gallery. And when I approached cinemas in the United Kingdom, they were very confused by this. They said, why would anyone go to a cinema to see an art exhibition? I explained it, you know, first of all, not everybody can get to London. And secondly, it's a springboard to doing a biography. We're still making a film. In the end, we got into 42 cinemas and 41 of them sold out. So then other cinemas started taking note. Then I got an American distributor, about the distributor who does the Met Opera. I got them on board to distribute the films in the United States. But we, after one season with them, we decided actually we'd, they basically booked the cinema, but we needed more. We needed it to, you know, we needed more support than that and a bit more marketing than that. So anyway, we decided to do it ourselves. And that first, those first few films were me looking to see where there were big exhibitions or my colleagues and approaching them. So there was a huge Munch exhibition in Oz. We didn't want it to only be London. That was very important. So, you know, we talked to the Van Gogh Museum. We agreed to do a film with them. And then the Munch Museums in Oslo. And of course, what then started to happen was galleries started approaching us. So I think the Girl with the Pearl Earring and other treasures of the Moritz House, they approached us, wanting us to make a film about the Moritz House. But again, we have to find a story. And I think it's a bit unproven whether there's an audience for a film just about an institution. People have tried. But I think you still need to find a story. So recently, our last film actually was about the National Gallery.
It was quite amazing, that film. I've watched most of it because I was able to stream it. And that's the one you're going to be showing on Vashon. So I wanted to see it in advance. And if in advance, I would kind of think National Gallery, boy, that sounds a little dusty, at least to people here. It's a large historic museum with a lot of white male artists who have created over the years, you know, and where's the excitement in that? And I was blown away within 5 minutes because there was something that was a bit transcendent, I think, about your approach, that you took us in through the stories of the people, at least as much as I've seen, the people who love the art. And they weren't just all curators or art historians or academics who could give you their elite version. It were people who loved a particular piece of art that you might not even like, but the love and the attention to the art was captivating.
It was really deliberate that it wouldn't, that it, we wanted people sitting in the audience to think that could be them. And in fact, it can. Now, 14 of the 21 are, I think it's 21, are staff members, but they could be gallery assistants, which you might call also a security guard, or somebody working in marketing, somebody working in wherever.
I think the second person in the film was an Afro-Briton security guard.
Yeah.
And I absolutely love that because, for one, he was in love with the art and he was very articulate, but he was also real, saying, someday I want my people.
Yeah.
To be on these walls as well, which captivated my heart. And so I thought, you're not giving us the traditional art history stuff that has become so dusty for us. Here's a living guy who loves his art, but he's very real.
But he's also nuanced because he says, you know, I don't really see myself represented on these walls. But he goes on to say, but the human emotion that is being displayed, albeit white-faced, but that applies to me as anybody else. So it's not he's not like saying, oh, this isn't for me because there's you know, I'm not here. He's saying, I love coming to work here. I love the stories here. This communicates to me just as much as anybody else, but I would like to see more Black stories.
There was also a quality of attention that I loved because a lot of times when you see people, like you go into the Metropolitan in New York, people are practically busloads of people are coming through.
Yeah.
And museums are crowded. You can only see a little bit, but there's a way that people look that's not really looking. But what you were offering us in the movie was people really experiencing the art, resonating, giving it time. And so not only was I curious about their experience of their piece, but I was saying, this is how one really draws in art. This is giving us a whole nother way to experience that a lot of us may not have had. And I thought that was very moving in and of itself.
You see, I think that's something that's in your background and in the work that you've done, because I've read a little bit, is that things are multi-layered. And sometimes, and it does take a little bit of attention. What we're trying to do with the exhibition on screen is encourage people to look. We're all moving too quickly. We don't taste the food, we don't look out the window, we're on a train, we're all on our phones too much. So when you go to see an exhibition on screen film, I'm giving you, might only be 20 or 30 seconds to look at a painting. Doesn't sound much, but it's still longer than you're going to get on television. Certainly longer than, TikTok. It's considered a view in a second. 1 second is considered a view. So when people say I had a million views, someone could have done that. I read a report recently which said that human beings now have an attention span of 7 seconds, which is less than a goldfish, which is 8 seconds. So I'm trying to slightly say, just slow down a bit. Now, one of our layered narratives in the film is to say, these individuals, at some point, somebody's taken made the effort, taken the time to take them to this gallery, which, it's an imposing building. People can be put off it. They've taken them in there, and the more sensible ones have said, like, there's a TV presenter who's one of our, it's 14 staff members, it's a couple of general public, and there's five celebrities like Michael Palin from Monty Python. But one of them says, my father took me here. Between the lines, her parents were divorced. This is what father did on a Saturday morning. And he said, we're going to look at one painting for 45 minutes, which is a lot of time. And what comes through in the film again and again, one, somebody had taken the time to take you for the first time. And two, people bring their own experiences to the paintings. Probably the strongest story is the one at the end of the film, which I won't talk about because people have to watch the film to see it, but it's an amazing story. And this particular person comes every single day for a particular reason to a particular painting. But the way that people see their own lives kind of reflected back at them through a particular painting. And this is one of the things you have to remember about artists. Van Gogh is a very good example. They all are, whereby there's always three parties in the conversation. You've got the painting or sculpture, I'm going to say a painting. You've got the artist, but that artist is always thinking about the audience. Who's going to be looking at this painting? In what context? Is it going to be on someone's private wall for very limited consumption? Is it, and how are they going to look at this painting? And these artists are completely controlling of our eyes. But then what's slightly out of control is somebody's personal experience, and how what's so interesting about the film is that the choices were so, there's some spectacularly famous paintings there, and there are some paintings I can guarantee you've never seen before. There won't be one person that sees this film that knows every painting. Even if you've gone to the National Gallery many times, there's no way that you're going to know all the paintings, because there's some that are hidden in corners. There's one that's come out of stores.
And some you
And
won't
of course,
even
you can.
like. I mean, there was one that was with the woman who liked horror films and the painting that she had. I was going, oh, I would never spend
I
time with
know.
this painting except through her eyes. It opened me that people have their own experiences, and that's beautiful, of the different paintings and all.
And it was also, of course, the 200th anniversary of the National Gallery. And it is interesting to know why they decided to have a National Gallery, and what does a National Gallery contain? If you think about it for 10 seconds, should a National Gallery only contain the work of the nation? Or does it try to tell the history of art internationally? Or is it just, well, we're just going to buy. Try and acquire the best art that we can get, and then you have a you know, in this case, you're in a country where you've got the British Museum, which has art as well. And then you've got the Tate, which has art as well, and other galleries. So how do you distinguish yourself? Even the fact that you already had a British Museum. So what are we going to call ourselves? We can't call ourselves the British Gallery. So they call it the National Gallery. You know? The 200th biography of the gallery is kind of dotted throughout the film. Yeah. That's also, you know, very interesting. And then they have having to think, well, where do we go? It is appalling that is it eight? Anyway, it's a tiny handful of all those paintings are by women.
Yes, yes.
Now, there may be historical reasons for it, but I mean that's shocking, really. And they try from time to time. But, you know, when I hear the National Gallery's wanting to spend, I don't know, 65 million on a Poussin or something, I'm like, no, stop. You don't need it. What you need to be thinking about is a Caribbean artist or a female artist, you know, that maybe you haven't, you know. So, you know, they still need to navigate their way forwards, you know, trying to decide what it means to be a National Gallery.
Yeah, and you don't sugarcoat that. That's available in the film for people to ponder, you know, what it is. And also, yeah. You know, you can't redo history, but it's apparent that there were actually more women tucked away than were ever given credit, and that with some searching, it's possible to find African artists, marginalized groups, women who were there. It can be done. But what I loved, and you had a diversity of viewers, which I loved. I loved that the ones who also made it like a meditation to come to the museum. And you felt like, you know, part of me was questioning, well, in this really troubled, anxious world we're in, what good's a museum? You know, isn't a museum just kind of taking us out of life? But you watch them and their contemplation, it was like, this is their happy place. This is where they're coming back into themselves. This is where they're getting a kind of soul sustenance so they can go back to their work, or go back out into the world. Yeah. And how fabulous that is. And how many of us really see that art is like a walk in nature. You know, it can be something that's really soul filling if it's approached in that kind of way. And that's, you know, part of what you're offering.
Also, of course, it's significant that, I mean, our National Gallery, unlike, say, the Met, is free.
Ours used to be.
I mean, I was in Chicago recently and I wanted to go and look at one painting. I can't remember what it was, like $35. And I just thought, you know what, it's just too expensive.
Yeah, yeah.
You hear all the arguments that it's expensive to look after and nurture and maintain and conserve and employ the staff. I get it. But, I find the United States very expensive anyway, but I just thought, you know what, it's just too much. National Gallery, you can just walk in.
Hear the stories even in New York of people whose artistic start was nurtured because their grandmother took them by the hand and they'd go into the Met on Sunday and they were exposed to art that way. So a lot of folks get exposed. And
well, I was going to say there's a danger that those that have a lower economic spending power then don't go because it's just too expensive. I bumped into a taxi driver. Now, taxi drivers can probably earn quite good money, but still, he was a taxi driver. And he said, you know what? Every so often, I know what he said. He said, I got so used to dropping people off at the National Gallery, but I'd never been myself. I decided one day to park my taxi cab and go in. He said it was free, so I had nothing to lose. He said, I absolutely love it. Come here all the time now. Now, if he'd had to pay $20 or $30 or $40 to get in that first time, he may never have done that. And one of the things that's also quite shocking here, and maybe it's true in the United States as well, we have, I think it's 2,300 schools for kids between the ages of 16 and 18. And I think only 8 of them teach history of art. I think that's appalling. You know, you think so much to be told through art. Whether you're teaching history or you're teaching about relationships or you're teaching about religion or whatever it might be, the fact that it's kind of so marginalized, it's a great shame.
Where are you going next? Are you waiting for the next great exhibit? Do you have stuff in the mill right now? And do you see yourself continuing for a while with the exhibition on screen, or are you going to veer off a little?
So Van Gogh Poets and Lovers is our 38th feature film for exhibition on screen. So we've been very productive. But I've just today been with the crew that are shooting the 39th, which is a really nice film called Dawn of Impressionism, Paris 1874. So if you like the Impressionists, you're going to be in for a treat. It's based on an exhibition that was at the Musée d'Orsay, right now is at the National Gallery of Art in Washington. Essentially, it's about the first Impressionist exhibition. It wasn't called that, it was called an independent exhibition, but in 1874 in Paris, where these artists, Morisot, Cézanne, Monet, Degas, Pissarro, got together to have an exhibition that was separate from the annual Salon. And that's a really, really interesting film. Like, who were these people? Why do they have this show? How? And the whole thing is being told just through the letters and the correspondence and the reviews of the time. No interviews, no narration. And that's going to be very strong. Then I myself am working on a film which I've been working on for about 4 years, actually, about Caravaggio. And then we have a film which is also being edited soon about Bert Morisot, the female, and again, an impressionist, but a female impressionist. And then we're always exploring ideas. I mean, we talk to galleries all the time. They come to us. We just had an interesting idea come from Canada. You asked earlier about do galleries financially support us? No. We don't get any philanthropic help. We get no help at all, really. I'd hope that maybe by now we'd have a sponsor or a philanthropist, or that galleries would see the advantage of what we do and would actually be able to pull some money out of their marketing budgets. None of that's happened, and the broadcast market has shrunk. I mean, of those 38 films, I did manage to get Hopper onto American Masters, and a couple of others played on a few American TV stations, but in the United States, that's it, which is shocking. You can imagine if there was like an arts channel or PBS. I mean, my life would be transformed if PBS said, yeah, we'll take them. We're making the film, we're creating the, it's a unique catalogue. At some point, somebody like Netflix will say, you know what, we've been focusing for 20 years on the 18 to 28 year olds. Now we want to focus a little bit on the older, more cultured demographic, which is an expanding demographic. We're about to hit the point when one third of the world's population is over 75.
Yeah, and they are consumers, and
And
they do benefit
yeah,
the advertisers, or yeah.
I don't know if it's a, it, there was a term that was employed. I don't know. I haven't heard it too much recently, and maybe it never made it to the United States, but we were called skiers, and SKI, which stood for Spending Kids
Oh yes, I've
Inheritance.
heard that. Yeah.
People are going on cruises and going to Europe to, I bump into people all the time who've actually quite extraordinary, who come to fly across the Atlantic. I mean, maybe environmentally it's not very sound, but to come to an exhibition, or they will go and tour, our demographic will go to Italy and tour the galleries. And maybe, so what would suit me is when a Netflix or an Apple or an Amazon says, actually, we can engage with that audience by showing your films. Because I mean, our films are, there are other people who do the odd film here and there, and they're very good,
Yes.
but we have a
Well, I
complete,
know, my husband's a little older, and travel is going to be challenging, and there are many great museums in the world and galleries and exhibits that are going to sell out. I couldn't even get in if I wanted to see them. So having beautiful films, intelligent films, moving films that can take me there, I think there's a great audience and people like me and us to expand our universe. without asking us to get on jet planes, you know, and do things that may be physically taxing. I know I've taken a lot of your time, but I have one question, which is, if you could just take us a little behind the scenes of your production, because years ago, you were a guy, a young guy with a camera that might have cost, you know, $6,000, and then you spent some money on an editor and maybe you got added a little soundtrack. But now you're a production company and you have to have folks who are doing an amazing soundtrack for you, writing, editing, interviewing, filming, editing, helping with the distribution, getting the money. How does that work? Like, give me a sense. Is it a 2-year arc for one of your exhibition on screen? Because some of them are timely. If somebody comes and says there's a Van Gogh exhibit coming up, you don't get 10 years to muck around with it. It's going to come out. You need to be ready. So what is that timeline like that you go through?
It can vary. So it can vary from 5 years on one film to hearing the idea and getting the film out within 12 months. The Van Gogh, we agreed with the National Gallery that we would have the film released during the run of the exhibition. And we hope that that will help us in terms of seat sales as well, because there's still a buzz about, you know, it's the biggest show that they've had for 20 years. Other times, you know, we take our time about something. So Caravaggio has been a long time in the works, for example. Normally a film will take, broad strokes will take 9 months to research, 6 months to shoot on and off, 3-4 months to edit. So, you know, and we've been releasing 4 films a year now for some time, sometimes 5, which is too many, really. That's an awful lot of work, and sometimes 3. The cinemas themselves, of course, I mean, they can pick from the catalogue and they can show one a month if they want to, because we've got these previous films, which, like you said earlier, are kind of timeless, really. So there's nothing stopping a cinema from showing as many films as they like for as long as they like. For us, we will continue to do, you know, 2 or 3 new productions a year. You know, keep our eye out for the big projects. You know, we have done Van Gogh before, but this exhibition was looking at him in a new and a different way and getting in paintings together that rarely seen together, and some paintings that are rarely seen because they're in private collections. And then there are, you know, artists that we may not have done, and there's certainly parts of the world I'd like to focus more on. I haven't done a great deal in South America beyond Frida Kahlo, who's Central America, really. But you know, if people don't come to the cinema, and again, because we're not funded, we have to be cognizant that if we, you know, we made a really nice film called Tokyo Stories, which was great, really energetic, 400 years of Tokyo-based artists looking at their remarkable city. And it had a lot of contemporary artists, a lot of young female artists like photographers, and didn't really strike the match with audiences, you know. So contemporary artists are a bit tricky. You know, who are the contemporary artists that are the equivalent of Raphael or Leonardo or Monet?
And then you have rights issues and things.
The rights issues. I mean, of course, it's great to actually, you know, when we did Hockney, it's nice to be able to talk to the artist. And even doing someone like Hopper, who was famously averse to doing interviews, but, you know, the 2 interviews we found of him, it's great to have visual footage. Lucien Freud the same. But, you know, if I was to do a Tracy Emin or I just don't think audiences around the world would come. Yeah. So that's slightly inhibiting. But there's plenty of ideas to keep us.
Well, let me ask you one last question. You're 61 now. Yeah. Is that accurate? I heard about read about your body of work, 250 films, my jaw dropped. That's so much. And then producing 4 or 5 films a year. Where do you get your energy from? And what sources you? You know, what keeps you going? Because you could, you know, you could hang it up at any point here, but it looks like you're going strong. So Where does that come from?
Well, this it's a nice question to end on because it actually brings me back to Vacheron in Seattle. So I was, my brother and I, well, my two brothers and I were born in New York. But we left when I was 1 year old and they were six and seven, went to England. I didn't come back to the United States until 1982. So I was 21. And I flew in with my brother Mark from India. So that's when I met the Dalai Lama and Tibetans for the first time. And then we came to, and we landed in Seattle. And I, you know, it's kind of going into my past, but because of my sister, I had a curiosity about the world. And even that trip to India, it just made me curious. So even engaging, you know, meeting the Tibetans, it wasn't like take a few pictures and leave them behind. I was like, I want to know more about them. I want to make a film about them. I want to. But when I came to Seattle, I remember going to a repertory cinema. Can't quite remember where it was. I think near a university, I seem to remember. But it was a wonderful, wonderful cinema where every day they were just playing classics. And I remember seeing Life of Brian and Monty Python's Holy Grail. The Meaning of Life in one showing. And it was the most fun. I used to go there. Sometimes my brother wouldn't come with me. And I just watched these films with my popcorn and absolutely fell in love with filmmaking. And when I went back to England and I got into film college, it wasn't the greatest. The teachers weren't the best. But from somewhere, I just had this energy. And the thing that, you know, where I do connect with some of the artists that I make is that at the end of the day, and I know you're an example of this too, you do have to have a capacity for hard work. And then when the door opens slightly, and I could list so many examples of where the doors just open slightly and I've gone kind of pushed through it. And actually you get so much back. It's like, if you want to be a documentary filmmaker, then you have to learn how to use your camera. You have to go to art galleries because these were the filmmakers before the invention of film. You can't just start filming with your camera and say you're a documentary filmmaker. It's like saying, picking up a pencil and saying you're an author. If you want to be an author, you need to read Dickens and so on and so forth. So, I'm sure there's been good fortune along the way as well. But I mean, the thing that kind of keeps me, ultimately, we are dependent on our health. And that can never be taken for granted. But I do love running. That's my thing. And so, I mean, I will go running with my brother Mark when I'm in Vacheron. And before we're in Vacheron, we're going to be up in Friday Harbor. We'll find some runs to do. I find that energizing. I was very lucky very early on to meet my wife, who's also my business partner, who deals, you know, she heads up the productions and deals all the finance. Without her input, Seventh Art wouldn't exist. None of these films would exist. So that was, again, good fortune. I think you can, I guess one bit of advice for filmmakers would be, you know, choose subjects that you're genuinely interested in rather than kind of chasing the money and doing something, because ultimately you're going to get difficulties. On every film I could list obstacles that we've hit, and it's your kind of passion to go around the problem or solve the problem that keeps you going forwards.
And I have a guess, and tell me, and this just from watching trailers, your interview, and one of your films, my guess is that there's something in the subject that you love. Something in the artist, something in the art, something in the musician. Am I right on that?
Oh, well, I mean, yeah, I could. I mean, the musicians, absolutely. I could listen to them forever. Mozart, for me, is the greatest genius of all. Closely followed by Beethoven, but there's something about Mozart. I could easily start another film about Mozart tomorrow. The film I'm probably proudest of is my child is my country, the 20-year project in Afghanistan, for all sorts of reasons. The art films, you know, I do love, you know, you put all the funding difficulties to one side. I love the creative challenge. And I work with really, you know, David, who actually directed the Van Gogh film, he's a fantastic collaborator. And I think with all these films, I love the challenge. If you have all this material, how do you turn that into a 90-minute cinema film? Because that's where we start. All these films start as cinema films. We make versions for television, but how do you entertain and engage and educate? And it comes down to a little comma here or a slight changing of framing. It's like when you frame something for a photograph or for when you're shooting, you have to think about it. How am I framing that person? You know, it makes a huge difference whether you look down with a camera or look up with a camera, or, you know, I don't hunt, but there's something nice about hunting for shots with your camera, trying to find the shot which helps you tell the story. Mm-hmm. Or doing an interview with someone, you prep very hard, as I know you have, because you're trying to get certain things from an interview, and then you reread those interviews many times to just get the line that you need to help tell this story.
Yeah.
It's like a big jigsaw. All that I find very exciting. It is quite tiring. And I think what's frustrating is when you make a film and it's very well received, you kind of wish that audience would just come to every exhibition on screen. Wouldn't cherry pick, oh, I've not heard of Tokyo, so I'm not, or Tokyo artists, so I'm not interested in that. But I will come to the one about Michelangelo because I've heard of him. And we also need people they enjoy it, to tell other people. I mean, you know, our audience, we always need bigger audiences, and it'd be nice to have a bit more comfort. But no, I mean, I love it and will continue doing it for a while. Yeah.
Well, I am so excited that you're coming to Vashon. What a treat, because I understand you're not really on tour. This is very special. You'll be going up to Friday Harbor for the film festival, but we are a special stop. So I hope we can.
Oh, no, the reason to go to Friday Harbor is to come to Vashon.
Yes, right.
So, and I've been to Vashon, and I wanted to do a Q&A in this cinema for a long time. So this is very exciting for me.
I will be there. I will definitely be there. And I will be calling out the troops as best as I can, you know, because my brother happens to be a videographer, and I was going, you know, this is so amazing to have someone with the depth of your experience coming in and being available for Q&A. Oh my gosh, you know, do people understand, you know, that this is such an opportunity? So, yay. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, I can't wait.
Thanks so much for listening. I look forward to being back soon and bringing you another conversation with an island creative who can show you how it's possible to embrace your muse and live your richest and most creative life. Till then, thanks for joining us, and thanks to Voice of Vashon 101.9 FM for hosting this show. I'm your host, Sally Fox, and I look forward to being with you soon.